What does a moderate sound like on social media? New research suggests that moderates do exist in large numbers. In fact, they're more larger numbers than their more extreme peers. So why does it seem like everyone on social media is itching for a fight? Turns out moderates tend to be quieter on social media than people who are firmly entrenched in polarized camps. That research comes from MU, and we're about to hear the details on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Michael Carney is on the line with us now from Columbia. He's an assistant professor of journalism, and he conducted this study. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
So did my synopsis get your findings basically right, or would you like to clarify some of the nuance there?
I'll clarify one thing, and that's that there are a lot of moderates, but most of them maybe do lean one way or the other when pushed or when forced to choose a side, but for the most part, they choose to avoid politics.
So how would you summarize your findings?
I would say that on Twitter, what you see more often than not in political conversations are the people that have very partisan beliefs or their minds already made up, and the people who are on the fence, unsure, or who might not be very interested in politics tend to opt out and to avoid politics, even in a highly contested, highly publicized election like 2016.
But you're not saying that those people aren't on Twitter. You're saying that they're just
right.
Being quiet about politics there.
Yeah, exactly. They are there. They're following entertainment accounts, sports accounts, friends, everyone else. And I'm sure they run into political content or to political accounts or discussion. And a lot of us go on Twitter and we might see political conversations, but that doesn't mean that we choose to participate in them or to follow them closely. And moderate users tend to focus more on entertainment than they do politics.
What strikes you as maybe not so obvious about this information?
Well, I think that 2016 in particular was kind of such a Twitter-centric election that almost seemed to border on not even politics as much as just entertainment. And even as it acted as like a form of entertainment, people who seemed to be mostly interested in entertainment still drew a line and still avoided following political accounts on Twitter. And it just seems like the more options we have with, streaming media, more and more cable news or cable channels, the more options people have to avoid politics and to avoid expressing their opinions on things.
Does this point to a rift in your mind between what appears to be the case if you treat social media as a mirror of who we are politically, mm-hmm. and then like what is actually the case in real life? Because a lot of people think that what they see about politics on social media reflects the general mood of politics on the ground.
Right. And I don't think it's really too much of a cause for concern, at least that not too much is changing too rapidly compared to, say, 20 or even 50 years ago. People who weren't very interested in politics or who weren't very confident in politics have always refrained from entering political conversations or from entering or engaging too much in politics. That hasn't changed. That's always been the case. But what does seem to be different is that with a touch of a button, we can get what we think might be the activity in the public sphere, and that what we're perceiving is not an accurate representation of it, because what we're seeing are the people who are most interested in politics, and those are the people that have their minds made up and who might seem more extreme than the general public normally is.
Let's try and correct for the illusions on social media. If you do not tend to pipe up about politics on social media platforms, I want you to call in now and tell us why. And I know that you are probably the least likely to also make that call. But seriously, do it. Because if someone's always posting about politics, we've heard from that person. We want the quiet lurkers to speak up at 816-235-2888. Help us understand what we're missing when we try to form a picture of politics that's based on folks who are posting a lot and not on you. 816-235-2888. We'll get back to the study in just a minute. But first, let's talk about the term moderate, because it's kind of a nebulous one. What's moderate to me might be Looney Tunes to you, and vice versa. Deborah Leiter is with us from UMKC's poli-sci department to get into that piece of it. Hi, Deborah.
Hello.
What does it mean to be moderate? Can that be objectively defined?
Well, it's a little challenging in that you can be moderate for a few reasons. You can be moderate because your preferences fall in the middle, right? You think that there's advantages to both sides. You don't want major changes. You can also be moderate because you don't have a lot of buy-in on politics. You're just really not interested. You don't really want to talk about it. It's not something that's important to you. And you can even be moderate because you have a grab bag of preferences. Some of the things you like are on the left. Some of the things you like are on the right. And that might make you think of yourself as a moderate. And of course, one thing that makes it a little challenging is we often tend to think of ourselves as more moderate than we really are.
Can you say more about that?
Sure. So most of us have friends with similar preferences to us. And we also tend to think of our own preferences as reasonable. Reasonable and moderate, especially in American English, they sound really similar. So psychologically, I will place myself at the center, even if I have preferences that are pretty far to the left or pretty far to the right, often also because most of my friends share those preferences too.
So this is kind of like we used to think that the Earth was the center of the universe.
Yes, and now we think of ourselves as the center of the universe. Yeah.
Okay, so I guess the other thing I'm thinking about is that this does kind of depend on your associations with the word moderate, because I am familiar with people in a lot of different social circles. I know people who would see moderate as a really positive thing in politics, and I know people who see that as a bad word, like status quo in not a good way.
I think that's right. I think especially for people who are really active in politics, moderate might be seen as someone who's refusing to buy in or change. For people who are either less active or maybe have an interest in sort of outcomes, moderate is the compromise position, the place where you can get things done. So what you want affects how you might see the role of moderates in politics.
What is the deeper significance of having a society with a lot of people who identify as being in the middle versus having more people on one side of or the other with very little in between?
Well, one thing we know is that sometimes I say, believe it or not here, parties tend to try to represent where most people are. So if you have a lot of moderates, you'll often have political parties that are more moderate. When you have parties shift, or excuse me, when the public shifts to the left or the right, very often the parties will shift. So the policy options, the political outcomes do in large part...
Do they start seeming more binary?
They often can, right?
It and seems that's, like compromise would be harder under those circumstances too.
That's exactly right. So when the middle disappears or when it becomes smaller, it's harder to find a place of overlapping preferences. And also, that attitude that we brought up before, that moderates don't have a buy-in, compromise might seem as, this is a strong word, but a betrayal of what your party should be doing.
Do you think that politicians in America today are basing their sense of where people are and what they want to see politicians doing on what they view on social media?
I think politicians take in a lot of information. The real advantage for politicians for social media is it's immediate. I can immediately see how the most active and most the people with the highest amount of tension respond to things I'm interested in. But I think politicians are also aware that social media users might be active and vocal, but they're not the only people out there.
Would you say that being a moderate is more about the force and certainty of your convictions, or is leftness or rightness the measure? Could you be casually extreme or passionately moderate, or would those be contradictions in terms?
I think passionate moderates exist. I think that they are the rarer beast. I think most people, if they're not certain about something, will say, oh, I fall somewhere in the middle. And I think that's how most people are. You could be a casual extremist, but I would like to chat with those people. I'm very interested in how you came to that conclusion.
What interests you about Michael's study, finding that there are lots of moderates on social media, but that they don't tend to post as much? This deviates from the sort of popular narrative.
I think this is a really important finding, is a reminder that we've known for a long time that social media isn't what we'd call a representative sample, that it isn't that people who are posting a lot don't reflect the mass of people. But the reminder that they are still there and listening tells us that social media has an effect, but isn't reflecting reality in the way that we might think. And I think that's really critical.
Michael, jump in here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with about everything so far, but I do think that there is an extremely reliable correlation between confidence in one's views and not moderate. And there's definitely that correlation plays out on social media much in the same way that we've been talking about in terms of participation. So the less confident you are, the more moderate you are, the less likely you are to engage in the conversation, but you're still there and you're still maybe forming your perceptions on the way the world looks to you based on that inaccurate representation of what you think politics might look like.
When I think about a politician like John McCain, I think that he might, I could just imagine John McCain really objecting to what you're saying right now.
Yeah, and I will say the people that object the most to the things I think we're saying are the true moderates that also happen to believe passionately about certain political issues or might be advocates or even representatives. And they have every right to disagree with what we're saying, but they are the minority. There's, I think Pew estimates that there might be 7% of the population that has well-defined political views and still classifies as moderate.
Did you measure moderatism, if that's a word, in your study? I mean, how do you study it in a way? You have to quantify it. And
right.
I'm also curious, how do you study what people aren't saying?
Right. And so actually, I think what the research suggests now is that the maybe one of the best proxies for trying to identify people who are moderate are the people that are tuning out of politics, because that correlation between kind of confidence and belief in political viewpoints correlates so strongly with partisanship that if we start to look at the people who more so exist on a medium in general entertainment, whether it's music, sports, or otherwise, that those people tend to be the moderates. And so I randomly sampled users that followed like Sports Illustrated, American Idol, CBS, Survivor, and compared them to people who followed people like Rachel Maddow, Sean Hannity, Salon, Huffington Post.
Let's talk with our listeners. I'm going to bring Sierra in Midtown in on this conversation. Hi, Sierra.
Hi.
So I asked for people who don't like post a lot about politics and especially their own political opinions on social media to call in and tell us why and whether this conversation we're having accurately represents them and their experience. You called in response to that question. What's your story?
So I personally don't consider myself a moderate, but I have several friends on my social media that have opposing views from myself. And I find it more peaceful, it's just better for me to not say anything that could be controversial to keep the peace. And I'm only talking to people that, you know, would be offended by what I would have to say. And in the small few that are going to actually be listening to me, they already agree with me. So I'm not changing anyone's minds by putting anything on the internet.
So you have a totally other reason for not speaking up, and it just has nothing to do with moderatism. Though the sample size of your social group and your network might sort of on average come out to be moderate just because you have people of conflicting views.
Correct, yeah.
That's really interesting. I'm curious, you know, Michael, from your standpoint, do you think that there could be a lot of Sierras out there, people who are just quietly keeping the peace, not quietly moderate?
There definitely are. And I will say that I think that that's a calculation that everyone makes to some extent if they have partisan views. Whether they withhold them kind of is a function of their how central that political ideology maybe is. And for some people, they make the calculation, well, if you disagree with me, then maybe you're not my friend to begin with, unless they maybe engage in politics more freely.
Or maybe you're a conversion opportunity.
Exactly. And I will say that in the study I did, what I kind of found that was interesting were the kind of the Tim Tebows or the people who were well known for music or sports who started to chime in on politics immediately saw a reaction in the people in the samples I was following. So, you know, Tim Tebow starts tweeting about abortion and suddenly he loses a lot of followers.
Well, we are going to get right back to this conversation about how and why taking the political temperature from social media is probably misleading. Things may look more extreme than they are. Does your experience support that? Call 816-235-2888 to join the discussion on KCUR's Central Standard. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the gap between how things look on social media feeds and how they really are in a non-curated, non-algorithmed version of reality. Our guests are political scientist Deborah Leiter and journalism researcher Michael Carney. Michael did the study that inspired this discussion. Hi again, you two.
Hello.
Hey.
Michael, we know that people's personal lives are more complicated than they appear on social media. So why would it be surprising that our politics are more nuanced than they appear as well?
Well, I mean, now we have to navigate more of ourselves, so to speak. I guess we all have a public self and a private self now, and we have to manage all of those identities at the same time. And politics is no longer something you just do in a voting booth. It's something you communicate in or choose not to communicate in. And all that kind of plays a role in how others view politics and how they start to orient their own political ideas and behaviors.
Deborah, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, there's this old idea of the public square where people would come and talk about politics. And now suddenly the public square is everywhere and in our homes and on our phones. And so I think this idea that
we don't have to look anyone in the eye there,
which is really quite convenient for politics and argument. But I think, what Michael's book is finding is that even without that eye to eye look, sometimes people still don't want to come and share their thoughts.
Sarah in Waldo is joining this discussion. We've invited people to call 816-235-2888 to speak up if they're the quiet ones when it comes to politics on social media. Is this conversation representing you and why you aren't speaking out? Sarah in Waldo, good morning.
Good morning, Gina. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that I'm in my late 20s. I got into social media in high school, and back then and in early college I used to post a lot more, and I would say I don't now, and I also used to be more politically on the left, and I'm interested in politics, so I've come more and more to the center and talking with people more on the right, but I'm definitely, I would say, would call myself a passionate moderate. And these days I don't tend to post as much just because it does seem like the people that are posting aren't really interested in sort of genuine conversation. Like you guys were saying, the public square is kind of everywhere and it's more about kind of yelling at each other and, sort of shouting out ideas without any interest in actually hearing,
Sarah,
what people have to say.
I want to try out a theory on you. I mean, a lot of what people are doing on social media is sort of like personal branding in a way. So if the things we're choosing to share are there, sometimes people share because they want a conversation, but sometimes people share because they're trying to establish something about who they are in their social worlds. And I'm wondering if your sense has been that people are sharing about politics to do more of that second thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is the kind of person I am.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in 2016, you really saw that with Trump being super divisive. Either you're vehemently anti-Trump and you want all your friends to know that, and you want people to know that he doesn't represent me and I'm not that kind of person, and kind of, just make that extremely clear to people, or you have a distaste for everything else out there besides Trump, and you think he represents a rebellion against the establishment and you want everybody else to know that, and you're not really, you've already settled that question for yourself and you want everybody to know that versus having a real conversation, I guess.
Sarah, have you ever...
I think the moderates like me get really sick of all of that, and it's just like you realize what sort of a facade that Facebook, those conversations turn into, and then you just stop posting because you're sort of sick of it all.
Have you had the experience of trying to engage in a conversation and then learning as it unfolded that no one really wanted to really engage?
Yes, I have.
can you tell this story?
Yeah, I don't know. There's nothing specific. I mean, it happens a lot in politics and it happens a lot in religion. If something happens, say the Kavanaugh hearings where everybody on social media is talking about it that day, and someone maybe posts an article and says, oh, this is disgusting, and maybe you respond and, try and look at it from a different angle or try and take a slightly different side. And there are some people that maybe say, oh, that's interesting. I think the important thing, if you are trying to have a civil conversation there, is assuming people's good intentions. And it's always nice when someone says, oh, that's interesting about this point that you made, but here's how I see it. So, like, assuming people's good intentions is important with conversations.
Well, thank you, Sarah.
Yeah.
Thanks for that call.
You're welcome.
I want our political scientist to weigh in on what Sarah just said. This is all really pretty interesting to me.
Well, I thought Sarah's point was really interesting. There's a little bit of a difference that maybe she hinted at that I picked up, which is for moderates, politics is personal, right? It's my private decision. I've evaluated things. For partisans or folks on the edges, politics is public. It's something that should be talked about. You should be taking sides. And I think...
And making an argument.
And I think as divisive as politics is right now, and as much as people are talking about it, there's not a mood to hear both sides of the story.
That's just not the mood right now.
Exactly. We're drawing sides. We're drawing lines in the sand, but politics is actually a spectrum, right?
She also gave the example of the Kavanaugh hearings where... although that is a political conversation, it gets into such intimate parts of people's personal stories that maybe what appears to be like a quote unquote civil looking at this from another point of view can feel very personal and very, it could feel like an attack when it's not intended that way.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. As we start talking more about social issues and as movements like the Me Too movement or Black Lives Matter have come out, it's become very much a part of people's identity beyond their political preferences.
Michael, jump in here.
Yeah, and I think maybe one side of this that we should also think about is, so there are kind of two schools of thoughts here. There's the Enlightenment thinking that politics is the realm where we try to do the best, and over time the best arguments win out, and the goal is to represent everyone and advance everyone's interests.
Like the grain of truth in every argument, and that once those emerge through argument, basically.
Right. And there's a kind of another side kind of that's maybe got some traction recently, which is that we kind of live in this antagonistic struggle between two sides. And as a result of that, we might end up better than we are, but it's more of a game. And so for those people that kind of think
or like
it's
a swinging pendulum.
Precisely. So if you kind of enter politics with this kind of personal, everyone's in this together mentality, then you probably do get offended when you see how a lot of people behave when they seem to be treating it kind of like a strategy game.
You know, a perspective we have not yet heard that surprises me to not have heard it. I imagine that a lot of people are very quiet in social media conversations about politics because of their position in whatever community they're in. Like, as a journalist, if I wanted to be out there proselytizing on issues and candidates, I can't do that. But that's not actually all that uncommon, whether it's a formal rule or not. You know, like a religious, like clergy generally wouldn't do that. Like a lot of teachers generally wouldn't do that. There are a lot of people who have a role in their communities where they really just can't be behaving that way. Is that something that accounts for just such a small number that it doesn't factor in here, Michael? Or
yeah, absolutely. I think that we have social constraints. So in addition to those moral constraints, kind of feeling like taking too strong of a stance or engaging in certain type of political arguments might be kind of a ethical or moral violation of how we view social media. There's also social constraints, not just with our friendships and their political viewpoints, but also in the connections we might have to a career, a position, our communities, and all those things kind of create these complex forces that constrain and shape our rhetoric on social media. But there's still space. I mean, like for every person I know that kind of is in a similar position to me as a university professor, and I think to myself, well, I should kind of constrain some of my dialogue. Then I see other people who clearly don't have those same constraints.
Or interpret them differently. Like
exactly, yeah.
That line between talking about politics and being political is something people view very differently, I've noticed.
Right, exactly.
Care to comment on this, Deborah?
Well, you know, I was, as this conversation was going on, I was thinking about a few cases of, say, restaurants that have made even pretty minor political statements and have seen a really massive online backlash, right? People calling for boycotts and bans and other people donating to those restaurants. And I think that when people see that, and it's quite a dramatic story, they're reminded that right now there's such a divisive mood that, yeah, there's a lot of people who say it's not worth risking my job, my friends, etc., to, say, make an ephemeral statement online.
Let's talk to Connie in Lee's Summit. Hi, Connie.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm calling because I think there's a time and place for political conversation, and for me, Facebook's not it. Here's what I use Facebook for. There is a company that will print and bind all your Facebook posts and photographs. And so everything I post to Facebook, I'm posting with an eye to what will make a scrapbook for me at the end of the year. And I post all pictures from my vacations, pictures of my kids. So it is a very curated view of my life, but it's a view that I print out at the end of the year with this company. They send me a book, and it's a great look back at the year for me.
And so a political argument you wouldn't want in there?
I would not want that in my scrapbook at the end of the year. However, on my Twitter feed, I'm pretty much all political all the time.
So if people follow you on one of those platforms or the other, they might be shocked to learn about the other Connie.
Well, most people know pretty much what I think, and I'm happy to talk to people in person about what I think, but I find people tend to be a little angrier, a little more aggressive on Facebook, and that's not something I need to look back on as a high point of my year.
When you say you do have those conversations in person, how do they tend to go differently?
They tend to go better because I'm actually curious about what people think, why they think what they think, where they're getting their information and why they believe things. And you can get a lot more information talking to someone face to face about that.
Without an audience.
Absolutely.
All right. Connie, thank you for that call.
Thank you very much.
You know, Michael, did you get into the question of why people are not posting?
Not in this study, but I have done some research that looked at Facebook and why people choose to engage or not engage in political conversations. And it kind of certainly lines up with what we've talked about so far. I'll also say that it's sort of interesting to see people navigate platforms like Facebook and Twitter and kind of know the intricacies enough to know when they can or can't engage in political conversation that can be seen by others. So on Twitter, for example, you might click on a tweet from Donald Trump and then realize that two or three of your friends have replied to that tweet with something nasty or something very positive, and it's something you don't normally see in your feed because those replies are normally hidden. Or on Facebook, you might go to a page or a group and suddenly see your friends who you've never seen post on Facebook before engage in very intense political dialogue. And those are usually strategic choices that we might make because we're aware that what we're saying is not just viewed by the one or two people we're directly talking to, but we're making these kind of complex decisions about politics or about our identity online every day.
Deborah, people might assume, when I said to Connie that people on one platform or the other might be shocked to discover the other Connie, but I am only kind of joking in that we might assume that the people who are the most vocal about politics on our social media feeds are the most politically informed or the most politically engaged, and that those who aren't doing that maybe don't care as much or aren't paying as much attention. That might be just totally not right.
I would love to say that the people who are most vocal are most informed, but unfortunately, we can't make that claim. Certainly, we can say the people who are most vocal often have the most intense preferences. But there are a lot of people in the sort of moderate center who do pay attention, but don't want to make waves. There are also a number of people who are moderate who are disinterested and aren't paying attention. And that's the challenge with studying or looking at moderates is there's a lot of ways you can be a moderate.
Let's talk to Rachel, who's called us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Gina.
What do you want to share?
I kind of wanted to talk about, because my training is actually as a folklorist, and specifically folklore in terms of looking at groups and how we form groups and perform in groups. And one of the things about the internet is that everybody often thinks of it as this giant conglomerate where you can go on the internet and you can see like all these different views, all these different opinions. But in actuality, that's just not what we do. There's a lot of confirmation bias that goes on in both what we choose to look at on the internet and also, you know, the friends that we surround ourselves with on the internet.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to friend or, you know, follow someone on Twitter who has views that are just going to be drastically different than yours.
Yeah, thanks, Rachel. That, it's true that we're unlikely to be seeing just a random sample of the population when we look at any of these platforms, right, Michael?
Yeah, exactly. And Rachel's actually described, I think, perfectly the concern and what kind of attracts me to this kind of research is that we very much do make decisions based on our own existing preferences, and we tend to select things we agree with. And that's kind of an equation for something maybe like a dangerous echo chamber that might exist online. But there's also a lot of situations where we might run into a dialogue that we don't think we've kind of selectively chosen. We might click a hashtag. We might do a Twitter search. We might see a news piece of news that quotes a tweet or references discussion that happens on Twitter. We might see trending stories or trending hashtags. All these things are kind of the peripheral parts of social media that represent or supposedly represent popular opinion, but really are representing kind of this selectively influenced group of people.
Michael Carney, thanks so much for talking about your study.
Yeah, thank you.
Michael teaches journalism at MU, and Deborah Leiter with us from UMKC's Political Science Department. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Up next, 5G service is on the way. But what are Gs, and why do we need so many of them? I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us for that discussion. You may have heard that Sprint is rolling out 5G service next month. And that is supposed to be really cool or something. But I will be honest, I don't really get what a G is, and I don't know why it helps to have a lot of them. Is 5 even a lot? We're going to find out on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Lily Lieberman is with us now from the Kansas City Business Journal. She's the tech reporter. Hi, Lily.
Hi, Gina. Thanks so much for having me.
In simplest terms, when it comes to telecommunications, what is a G?
What is the G? All right, so G stands for generation. So just think like there's different generational differences between baby boomers and millennials, millennials and Gen Xers. There's a difference between 2G transmitted voice, 3G brought us texting, you know, and then 4G brought us streaming. And so 5G is going to bring us something completely different.
Gs aren't quantitative.
No.
Oh my God.
Isn't that crazy?
It is.
Yeah. So it's a generational thing. For right now, you can think of it kind of as one half marketing term and one half real world potential, right? So really, you shouldn't think of it as a brand new technology at all because it's really an evolution of the existing 4G LTE. And this evolution is really hard to put a finger on because companies of all sizes, especially in Kansas City, are trying to figure out what it means for them. So basically, I can break it down for you.
Yes, please.
Okay. So into three different categories that's it's going to enhance for users or companies. So number one is speed, obviously. 5G could be, I've heard 10 times faster. I've heard 100 times faster than 4G. It could be infinite. We don't know yet. That's the thing.
All we know is that it's the next thing.
Right. That's
okay.
All we know. That's
but these
all
are
know.
Some theories.
These are theories. And it could have really extremely low latency, meaning data can be delivered just in instant critical situations, which is really helpful for use cases like in healthcare or, you know, ambulances when they're trying to deliver data really, really quickly. And then, so the second thing would be capacity, so the ability to hold more data, right? And then the third is coverage, so reaching all users regardless of where they are. So not just in those dense urban areas, but everywhere in rural America or in low-income neighborhoods and things like that.
So then people couldn't be like, oh, sorry, I was somewhere where I wasn't getting service.
Yeah, it may put a damper on your plans if you're not good with texting back.
And, I was in a big cement parking lot.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
So 5G will be able to penetrate those walls and actually get into buildings better. And
maybe.
Well, yeah, maybe.
Okay. It is interesting to me that they're announcing something like as though there is something that it should mean to us, when actually it seems like it shouldn't. It, like 5G, even you don't know what that's going to mean.
Right. We don't know what it's going to mean. But I think what's exciting about 5G is that there's endless possibilities. And that's really what the discussion is all about, is how is speed, capacity, coverage, low latency, and all of these things that, you know, we can only dream of, really, going to affect, you know, local businesses. I mean, let's start in Kansas City, for example. As you know, as you said, Kansas City is going to be one of the first places to get it because of Sprint. So they've promised to bring it to us here in May. And I think, you know, Sprint's been kind of careful not to really focus on the specifics necessarily. And very smart on their part.
Because that translates to expectations.
Right, exactly.
And then complaints.
Yes, and complaints. But it's more about the experience of 5G.
But if we're all making up our expectations, you don't think that has its own dangers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But I think it also feeds that ingenuity and innovation that we really strive for. You know, there'll be so many more opportunities to create things. You know, the Internet of Things we talk about, you know, everything's going to be connected at some point, and this is the start of that.
When you say that these are different generations, is there sort of a threshold for how different a service has to be to count as a new generation of service? Or can someone just say, I'm doing something better, slight rebranding, little tweaking, and I'm going to call this, you know, I come along with 6G. Is there a threshold that is agreed upon that, like, we have advanced to a new, like, an entirely new idea of what this can be?
Right. And I think you've hit on something. You know, there's such a race right now to get to 5G, and all carriers and, you know, wireless companies are trying to capitalize on 5G and what it means. There are some companies, and I won't name names, but are trying to capitalize on that 5GE, which... What's that? So 5GE, they say, is 5G evolution, right? And they've been careful to brand it as the evolution. But it's, you know, it's clear that 5G services aren't really here yet. So it's kind of the way station between 4G and 5G. And that's where we're at right now. I mean, there's really no way for us to say 5G is going to come, you know, September 2020. We don't know. So right now, you know, 5G, like I said earlier, is half a marketing term at this point, but there's so much pressure and such a race to get to 5G that companies are doing whatever they can to kind of capitalize on that marketing term and turn it into something that maybe it isn't really yet.
Can I just ask the most basic of basic questions?
Sure.
How does this technology even work? I mean, I'm thinking about when the late Senator Ted Stevens famously proclaimed that the internet is a series of tubes. And I mean, in the cell phone world, how is information being sent around by cellular devices? I know that it is not a series of tubes, but I don't know what it is.
Okay. So to really break it down, and I'm new to this too, so bear with me, okay? So there's bands of frequency, and all of these telecom carriers have spectrums that they have bought, right? And so, for example, Sprint and T-Mobile each have different bands of spectrum that they think, when they merge, will help them. The marriage of those two spectrums will give them better 5G capabilities together. So, you know, Sprint has a big, big platform of mid-band spectrum that can reach across, you know, wide ranges of coverage, right? Or actually, sorry, capacity. And then T-Mobile has a lot of low-band spectrum, which can do coverage. So together, they can do coverage and capacity. So there's a lot of nitty-gritty things, like if I talk about small cells and implementing massive MIMO and...
Yeah, it's gonna another language.
It's another language. It honestly is another language, and I'm learning it too. But right now, I can tell you, you know, what you'll be seeing in Kansas City is the deployment of small cells, which are about the size of a pizza box. And
so compared to cells in biology, giant, but small in cell phone world.
Right, exactly. Okay. So these other macro cells, as you would call them, usually the size of a refrigerator or something like that. And in the telecom world, they call them furniture, is what I've learned, which is kind of interesting. So, yeah.
Well, what do they do?
So they are there to kind of help densify the network. So there's that old joke, you know.
So just filling in the space that exists in the world with coverage.
With coverage. Yes. Exactly. So...
I still don't know how it works, but I want to focus on 5G again, okay. Because I have come to understand on a very superficial level, and I'd like you to explain it to me better, that this is the race to 5G is kind of like our modern day space race.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. It's really interesting how companies have positioned themselves. And how they're, you know, even in recent congressional testimony saying that this is the most important thing that we can do to position ourselves not just for the future of the United States, but like the future of the world, basically. So, you know, and it's a huge revenue opportunity as well, I think.
But who are the competitors here?
So China is what they're saying is that, and really, do we know if they already have 5G capabilities? I mean, they've got...
We don't even know what 5G is. We just know that it's what's next.
Right, right. So it's all a guessing game. To be honest, it's, do you have it? I don't know. Do you have it?
We better get it because you might be getting it.
Right.
It's really weird.
It's bizarre, and I cover it, and I don't understand it. So there you go.
It does relate, though, to this merger between Sprint and T-Mobile, right?
Mm-hmm. It does. It does. So, you know, like I was saying, they keep telling us that neither can really provide a 5G network as a standalone company. And Sprint has even come out and said that they don't have the money to roll out 5G as a standalone, that they would need to borrow $20 to $25 billion to roll this out, which is unsettling considering they've promised to roll it out in Kansas City and three other cities by May. So, you know, what does that mean for us as a city too, if the merger doesn't go through? If it does go through, It's still going to take a lot of money. I don't know where it puts them, you know, in terms of how they're positioned with, you know, AT&T or Verizon or anything like that. It's just, it's not clear.
So do businesses, when you say what does that mean for us as a city, are there businesses that are sort of planning ahead based on assumptions about what 5G is going to allow them to do? Because it seems to me, as far as I understand it, this affects businesses more than individual consumers, probably.
Probably, right. So, you know, I don't think we're going to see much of an impact right away locally, but, you know, businesses should be aware of what's coming. It might not be right now, but it will be within the next couple of years. So, like I was saying, there's an endless revenue stream, so they say, through the digitalization of services like healthcare, which is really huge here in Kansas City, you know, and transportation.
Companies like Cerner.
Absolutely, which is another company that I do cover. And so, you know, reports estimate industry revenues from digitalization could top like $1.3 trillion in 2026, which is insane. I mean, as far as what type of industries, you know, there isn't much buzz that I've heard in Kansas City outside of tech-savvy industries, you know, like healthcare and transportation, that are really, you know, seizing the opportunity at the moment because it is too new to really do that. But there are several use cases that I find interesting that could have potential.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think artificial intelligence is something that we're all really interested in, the singularity and being trapped in the matrix and all that kind of thing. But AI could potentially power construction, the construction business, to streamline the process of building. Virtual reality controlled remote surgery. So, you know, someone in at Children's Mercy could be doing surgery for someone in California, which would be incredible. You know, jury duty could even be remote at some point, or you could interact with the crime scene from your, you know, little jury stand. So that could be cool. Or maybe you don't even have to leave your desk for work, or you could do it from home.
So when we talk about G's, I do want to get back to my ridiculous assumption that we were talking about something quantitative, because
sure.
It does sound like people are talking about that it's something physically big, like that something is getting bigger, like I've got 5G service.
Right. Yeah, people do talk about it as if there's this seismic shift or kind of almost not apocalyptic, because that makes it sound like it's, you know, a bad thing, but like we're on the precipice of some great revolution. And I think that we are, to be honest, but it's not the generation of there's so many possibilities that it's hard to, like you said, quantify what it means.
What is the difference between 3G and 4G? And maybe that will help us appreciate the scale of change we are about to encounter. Probably.
So 3G gave us texting, right? So that was incredible. You're able to text your friends and send SMS messages and things like that. And then that jump from 3G to 4G was, you know, streaming YouTube videos and doing what we do now, Snapchat, you know, engaging in all these different, like, apps and, you know, I don't know, whatever, Instagram, all those things that you use. So an Internet of Things, but on your phone. So I think
so before 3G, we were just interacting with our voices on cell phones.
Exactly.
With 3G, we're interacting with text. Mm-hmm. With 4G, we're interacting with, like, motion and video and image. And so now there's a leap of that scope.
Right.
Ahead of us.
So, right, exactly. When I talk about that, I think the best way to put that in perspective is kind of you're looking at the Internet of Things, and that's really the connectivity between devices, of all your devices. You know, your cell phone will be connected to your home. I think a really good example would be a smart city, a way to put it like that.
But is this like I'm going to lose my cell phone and I won't be able to turn off the lights at night?
No.
Okay.
At least I don't think so. I'm not sure about that. Can't confirm. But you know, the world's connectivity needs are changing. And I think that's pretty clear. 4G is not going to be able to keep up. You know, there's just 5G will be able to promote greater connectivity, interconnectivity among users. And we have to kind of look at this holistically. We need that interconnectivity between everything. And I think 5G will be able to do that.
I mean, speaking of space races, do you think Kansas City has an edge that we're getting 5G early over other cities? Or is it going to happen too fast for that to really matter?
I don't know. I mean, Google picks us for some interesting things, so something must be in the water.
Well, Libby Lieberman, tech reporter for the Kansas City Business Journal, thanks for talking G's with me today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks so much.
I like the letter G.
I do, too. Love the intro music, too.
Sprint releases 5G service in May in Kansas City. That's a wrap for today's show. We talked earlier in the hour about why social media appears to be so polarized. when it's actually populated by plenty of moderates. At least that's what an MU study suggests. That conversation will be available with this one at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we archive all our past shows. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow is a food show. We will take you with us to an acclaimed local bar to find out if it lives up to the hype. We have an expert drinking buddy, but you have to listen to our cocktail and happy hour show to find out who it is. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.